This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network studio here in glorious Clearwater, Florida. And it is a glorious day. This is the kind of day that just everybody knows it's a Florida day. It's so perfect. Not too hot, definitely not too cold. Just perfect. And I am so happy today. I've got really only one guest because I just wanted to talk to her. And she's just so remarkable. And we have a lot to talk about. I am so happy to welcome back to Joy on Paper, Brooke Allen. Hi, Brooke.
Hi, Patsy. It's good to hear your voice. Oh. And I'm having a Virginia day here. It's gorgeous, too.
Well, you have fall. Oh. Yeah. Are the trees turning?
They are. You know, last year it was odd because they didn't start really turning and getting colorful until like late October, early November. But this year it's been much earlier and it is just beautiful out.
I know. My son has been sending me pictures from up north, you know, of course, up in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota. The leaves are so gorgeous. They have so many maple trees and the colors are incredible, and I've been so enjoying. Every day he's sending me a new picture, and it's just wonderful.
It's pretty vibrant out there. In fact, today I'm hoping to take a cycle ride, so that should be fun.
Well, you know, it seems like yesterday that I was up in Wisconsin and I was having tea with Margaret George. And as we were, she made me a lovely tea and we're sitting in her lovely room there overlooking her garden, all with all these windows. And it was such a lovely time. It was winter. I was up there in a winter and there was still snow on the ground. And we were having this wonderful tea. Prepared this British tea, and then she said, "Would you like to see a manuscript?" And I thought she was going to show me one of hers. I thought, "No, yeah, sure." And it was yours, and it was she was so excited. And of course, Margaret George is so famous for her wonderful historical novels, including, of course, Henry VIII, which she wrote by hand. Can you believe that? And and of course, Cleopatra. And so when she brought out this manuscript, and she showed me, she said, "This is so good. This is so good." And so we spent a good deal of our tea party talking about Brooke Allen. She said, "Whoa, Brooke is so good." And she talked about how you got in contact with her. So it's I can't believe we're at the third book, the last. This is a trilogy.
If you can't believe it, I am stunned. This has been a 15-year journey for me, and I am floored. And, you know, Margaret George, you brought her up, and she has just been such a dear, kind, warm friend. I was really blessed. I had no idea that one little email would turn into this extraordinary friendship, and it has. I'm just so thankful for her.
And, of course, the subject, of course, right away got her interest because it's about Marcus Antonius, and the new book, the third book, is called Soldier of Fate. And it is fantastic. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed it. I really savored it. I was having so much fun reading it.
Oh, I'm so glad. Yeah, in high school I just loved Julius Caesar by Shakespeare. I thought it was fantastic. And I finally did read Margaret George's Memoirs of Cleopatra, and I loved it. And I got to thinking, you know, I've always wanted to write the late 1st century BC Rome, that incredible transition between the imperatorial period, the end of the Republic, to the imperial period. And I was like, wow, how can I do this, though? I need a new angle. So I decided a retelling would be great, but from whose point of view? Well, Cicero had been done. Of course, Margaret George and several other writers have done Cleopatra. And, of course, Julius Caesar has been done. And I just thought, you know, who is out there? And I kept coming back to Antony. I thought, you know, Marcus Antonius's story was always told by his enemies. He has never really had any major attention given to his point of view as to what it was like living that decade before the imperial period began under Augustus. So I thought, wow, this would really be a cool adventure, and it has been. It's been such a learning journey for me. I've been some amazing places. I've read some amazing books, and I've met some incredible people, including yourself and, of course, Margaret. And, wow, yeah, to think that all three books are now complete and will soon be out there for the public. The first two, of course, already are. And my third one will launch this Friday. So I am absolutely delighted, and it's an exciting week, a busy week, but one that every author, whenever there's a launch week, it's just, it's such a joy, because finally you get to share that project with the world, and it's a humbling experience and an exciting one for sure.
Well, you know, you had so many years of the research part and the thinking about it part, and then the actual publications sort of came one after another rather quickly, to the delight of your readers, because sometimes, you know, when you have to wait a long time, like years between books, we didn't have to do that. I mean, this really moved along with, but of course it had all been in your head for quite a while, I think. You've been living with Marcus for a long time.
Yeah, my husband's been very indulgent with me, hasn't he? I had most of it written. And once I got an editor's, you know, advice and expertise on this, it was made clear that we needed to do either a series or a trilogy, and we both decided to settle on the trilogy. And I will say this, that I only had probably the first third written of the final book, Soldier of Fate, which is coming out Friday. And it was like, wow, I've got to do this very quickly. Well, along comes COVID-19. And, you know, that was not something any of us were thrilled about seeing and experiencing. And everyone has had losses in this. But at the same time, for me, as an educator, I teach part-time as well, so I still have a day job. And suddenly, I, you know, wasn't working. And, of course, I was doing some things with students, but this was my opportunity to just sit down and really focus on my work, on my novel, and not have to come home from work and make it my secondary, you know, second priority. It was wonderful being able to just focus on being an author, focus on getting the story down and doing the drafting process. And I wound up doing like 6 drafts on this one, which was pretty expedient for me. Usually I do more, but it went really quickly and really well. And I think it's because I had the other two novels to kind of model his character from. And I did know more about where I was going. Of course, history dictates a great deal at this stage of the game with the story of Antony and Cleopatra. But at the same time, I did have plenty of reworking to do, and there are some twists. Even at the end of the story. So.
Yeah, it definitely, it is one of those stories where you know the ending, but boy, the journey to get there is the fun part.
It is, and oh my goodness, for him it was not fun, was
no.
it?
Oh, wow.
There are plenty of battle scenes, of course, the huge naval battle, and boy, I'll tell you, that was really a tough thing to recreate, simply because there's never been a complete Roman warship discovered. They've discovered bits and pieces of them, and of course cargo ships, such as the Antikythera ship in the Aegean has been found. You know, there are plenty of naval remains, but they're scanty. They're very scanty. There's never been that complete warship. And so, you know, it did take a lot of reading and research to try to put that together and what it may have looked like. I used a lot of the studies from Dr. William Murray from, I think he's at Florida State University's classics department, and he had done very in-depth research on the Battle of Actium and leading up to that, as well as the propaganda. There's the Paul Zanker books on Augustan propaganda that were really helpful. And there's a new book out on the Battle of Actium by Cy Shepard that I found extremely useful. It was sort of my axiom Bible by the end of my writing journey in this story. He was really good at bringing out some very different perspectives on the time frame and what the chronology was on the battle, because Patricia Southern, who has been one of Antony's biographers in the last decade, she was very outspoken in saying, you know, there is no chronology that goes along with this, because it was all Augustan propaganda. It was, you know, again, his history was written by his enemies. So there you have it, you know. Having to make sense of all of that was really a challenge for me. It really was.
Well, I think one of the highlights of your books are the battle scenes. You really do capture that excitement. And as someone who, I mean, that is my favorite reading. Military history is what I like the most, actually.
Wow.
Even above Jane Austen. I tend to gravitate to military history. I love military history. I have like maybe, I don't know, 50 books, Napoleon, Waterloo. I've lived it over and over so many times. I've walked the battlefield there. I think one of the most exciting moments in my life was when the first time that I went to Waterloo, and my husband didn't quite understand. I mean, he knew I loved books. We were, you know, he knew all of that, but he had no idea of my the depth of my understanding of Waterloo. And so when we get there, he's thinking like it's, you know, a little tourist stop, and we're going to have lunch there. And then he discovers that I am there. I am living. Yeah. I am living it almost minute by minute, because I had read so much about it, and I'm crying. And I mean, there were tourists all over the place, but I'm walking around in places, and I'm saying this happened here, and I'm crying. And mm-hmm. he got so, like, he was very impressed, because I had never talked about it, but once I was on that spot, it overcame me. And so for you,
wow.
You know, you too, you've walked these places, you've gone to so many of these places. Doesn't it really, it gives you some, a special feeling for the events?
It really does. I went to two places in Greece, really just floored me. And I think the thing, after going to the site of, say, Nicopolis and the Battle of Actium, you know, that bay, there on the western coast of Greece, as well as, say, the plains of Philippi in Macedonia.
I know, I've been there.
Yeah. I think the thing that really struck me, especially at Actium, was the size, the magnitude of the theater of war. I was floored. I was like, this is a time before walkie-talkies, before Morse code. This is a time before telephones or computers or... You know, and how did they do this? Because it was massive. I mean, it's you know, at least 10 to 20 miles in circumference what this space entailed. And it really did, Patsy. I think that was the thing that just floored me above all. Although I was at Philippi, and my guide, Ioannis, did a magnificent job. And he said, look, I want to take you... I was with a friend. I mean, he took me aside singly, and he said, you know, I want to take you up to the top of this theater. You know, it was the theater that Philip of Macedon had built for the city. And what's really cool, too, if you ever go, is it's still in the round. The traditional Greek theater, you know, orchestra is still round. It was not paired off by the Romans like so many of them were. And anyway, so we go to the very top of this theater, and he says, now turn around, and he says, behold the battlefield of Philippi. And I was just like, you know, gasping, because, you know, there's just this massive farm field out there. Now there are some trees now, and, you know, I think to a certain extent geography can change with rivers, etc. And back 2,000 years ago, part of it was a marsh, believe it or not. Very watery, not very good for, not all of it was very good for farming. Some of it may have been. Anyway, I was at the top of that theater, and there's this huge hill mound kind of in the distance, and he said, now I want you to pay attention to that mound. He said, farmers have been, you know, grazing stock and you know, piddling around there for years. And he said they found a lot of artifacts and some bone fragments. And he says it's believed that possibly that could be a burial mound where there were cremations of soldiers who died in the battle, you know. And so I was like, I have got to use this theater in my book somehow. So in my second book, Second in Command, the very ending takes place there on the battlefield of Philippi, and I have people actually sitting in the theater overlooking the battle, watching it take place. And the very end, I have Marcus going up, you know, Antony going up into the top of the theater and overlooking the cremations of all of the soldiers that are taking place and smoke rising, you know. And I tried to describe that. And, you know, it was just, for me as a writer, a really emotional moment connecting to the place and remembering what it was like for me and trying to imagine what it would have been like for a general to see all of that going on. Wow. Really, well, a powerful moment for me.
and powerful in the book. And that's why I think your books, all three of them, are so, they have this depth, and so much of the depth comes from not just having read, you know, we can all read a lot. I had read so many books about Napoleon and about Waterloo, but until I got there, I didn't have that feeling that, and even now, it brings tears to my eyes. And
yeah,
so
it's powerful.
It's powerful. Now, tell my listeners why this battle was important. What did it mean in history?
Philippi was the culmination of basically the Roman Republic. It died on the fields of Philippi.
Yeah.
In 44 BC, many of your listeners are probably aware that Julius Caesar was assassinated by Brutus and Cassius and another group of senators. And in some minor civil war conflicts that occurred after that, it was finally determined that Octavian, who was Julius Caesar's great-nephew, he had also come to power, and he and Mark Antony finally developed a peace treaty, and they joined their forces. And at that point, they were equal in strength, pretty much, to what Brutus and Cassius had put together in eastern Greece and in Macedonia. And so Antony and Octavian took off in boats, brought their armies over to mainland Greece, marched across the country to meet Brutus and Cassius in battle. And so what transpired really was quite an ordeal for both sides. There was a lot of starvation and deprivation on the side of Antony and Octavian, because many of their transport ships were unable to reach Greece because Brutus and Cassius had a great navy under the command of a gentleman by the name of Enobarbus. And Enobarbus probably confiscated a lot of their ships, their supplies. Cleopatra, it is said, tried to aid them to send you know, food and men, possibly a small force of soldiers. And she was met with bad weather, and her ships had to turn back. Some were apparently lost off the coast of North Africa. So, you know, there was a lot going on. There was a lot of tumult. There was also the fog of war, because Gaius Cassius killed himself in a mistake. It was a message that, you know, our battle is lost, Brutus has given up the ghost, and that was not the case, as a matter of fact. But he acted too quickly, he killed himself, and Antony took the day. About 3 weeks later, Brutus finally offered battle, and it was a good thing he did for the Antonian army, because they were starving by that time. So, anyway, Brutus wound up losing the battle, and again, Antony was the one who kind of took the field and really was the victor of Philippi. All of that propaganda concerning that particular battle was changed after his death by Octavian, and he took full credit for that battle, which I've always thought was just horrible. You know, he won, so why did he do that? But he did, and he took took the glory for that day, even though it really had belonged to Mark Antony.
Yeah, well, Octavian has a lot to answer for. There's a lot of, he's quite a character. And I'm going to take a quick commercial break. And
okay.
You hold on. And when we come back, first I want to, we're going to talk about Octavian, Octavia, and also I want you to describe Cleopatra's ship and so many other things. So just hold on, a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with the Z, and I am back with my very special guest today. To talk about her third and final installment of the Antonius Trilogy, Brooke Allen. Whoa, I am so glad that you are with me today.
Oh, it's just a joy to be back on Joy on Paper.
Okay, great. Well, the new book, Antonius, Soldier of Fate, is going to be available on Friday. Well, we don't know where her books are, but definitely on Amazon. And again, as always, a beautiful cover. You have some of the most beautiful covers ever. They are just gorgeous.
Oh, thank you. And that is compliments of my incredibly talented editor. Does also my designing for me. And she is extremely creative, very gifted, and we talk very deeply about what we are wanting to achieve in a cover every time we put it together. And this third one, I think it's my favorite.
It's beautiful.
It's awesome. it turned out great.
It really is. It's absolutely gorgeous. And, of course, I want to tell people they should also go to your webpage, because you have a lovely webpage. It has the covers of the book covers. It has information about things that are coming up. You have a virtual book tour, I think, coming up, and you people can sign up for a newsletter, and it's real easy to remember. It's just Brooke Allen, and it's brookeallen.com, and it's a really great website. Very, very beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah, I do want to just throw it out there that this coming Thursday evening at 6 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, there's a link on my website where folks are welcome to sign up. A local bookstore here close to where I live is throwing me a virtual launch party.
Wow.
And so I'm looking forward to that immensely. And of course, the book will be available for order. And I just hope some of my readers will join us. It's going to be a great time.
Oh, I hope so too, because you're fascinating. The story that you have created here in this trilogy, you know, it's, we want to bring him back as a ghost so we can have a fourth book. It's just so good. It's so good. There's so many things to love about the book. The wonderful research that you've put into it, the heart that you've put into it, which I think comes so much from your travels. And I want to talk about that. But before that, I want to just, let's talk about one particular scene and set the stage for us. Paint us a picture of, you know, once Marcus Antonius is on his way, he actually wants peace, but he wants to take a piece of the world too while he's at it. But tell us about the time that Cleopatra comes with her ship, because that is beautifully done in the book.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, they're meeting at Tarsus, you know, was legendary. It really was. Truly, this couple became a legend in their own time. You know, it didn't take their deaths to create a legend. They were already there. You know, they really were. In Tarsus, Antony was visiting that city. He was pretty much claiming the East as Triumvir of the East in the name of Rome. And he was apparently holding some sort of litigations outside in their market area, their agora. I'm sure it was kind of a Greek city, even though it was located in what's now, you know, parts of Turkey. Tarsus had a river, the Kidnus River, that went into its area. And apparently in the market square where Antony was located, the market started emptying out. And, you know, from his point of view, I'm sure he wondered, is there some kind of unrest? What's going on here? He sends one of his officers to go check it out. And it turns out that Cleopatra has arrived with her ship. And many of us are probably remembering what it looked like in the movie with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. It really was a glorious ship. The oars had tips of their oars were actually dipped in silver. I mean, you know, I'm like, wow, really? But it was an extravagant ship. Apparently she used roses that were several inches deep on the decks so that there would be this lovely aroma of flowers the whole evening. She used special lighting, you know, lighting effects were being used 2,000 years ago, and she used tiny little lamps and niches all over the ship to decorate it and to make it look beautiful. And Antony and some of his officers, of course, attended a banquet thrown by the queen on board this amazing vessel. And that's where he met with her, and they talked politics for the first time together. And in my story, there's already kind of there's definitely chemistry going on there, having gone on for some time. So anyway, it's just a really fun. It was a fun scene to create, and one that was easily done and easily returned to for edits because I kept adding to it and adding to it. I don't want to take too much away because oh my gosh, I mean it was probably all like this there, you know.
Well, she was a very clever woman. She certainly knew how to stage something that was impressive. Tell us from, you know, you've taken a new look at Cleopatra, and there's a lot more depth to her, I think, in your book that some people might not realize.
Yeah. You know, and the first thing I want to stress is that Cleopatra's heritage was Greek, not Egyptian, not North African. You know, not Syrian so much. She was Macedonian Greek. You know, the Ptolemaic dynasty was started by one of Alexander the Great's generals, Ptolemy Soter. And so, you know, her lineage was Macedonian. I don't know exactly what she looked like. She may have had dark hair. She may have had blonde hair. But Cleopatra was extremely learned. She was very adept at languages. She spoke at least seven. And apparently she angered Cicero at one point because he wanted to speak Latin with her. And either she couldn't or she refused. I think she probably was giving him a hard time right back and just refused speak his language. Let's just resort to Greek here and make him the one, you know, on uncertain territory. And she probably was like that. She tested people. She was very perceptive. She could read people. She knew that Antony would like an extravaganza such as she presented on her ship the first, you know, night of their meeting. Cleopatra was also a mom. She was a mom 4 times. And what's really extraordinary to me was that she was the mother of twins. And for any woman to be able to do that safely with both children surviving in the ancient world without any kind of pain medication or, you know, really nice medical care, to me is amazing that the children survived. There were Alexander and Selene were their names, and Alexander was lost to history, but Selene went on to be a North African queen, so she really fared quite well. Cleopatra was very much loved by the Egyptian people, especially in Upper Egypt. She honored them with temple sites that were either expanded upon or built more completely upon. Her father did some of that too, and she just added to it. She had a real spiritual side to her. She associated herself with the goddess, the Egyptian goddess Isis. And I think it's interesting, so many of the Ptolemies associated themselves with some of the Greek gods or else created gods such as Serapis, which was kind of Egypto-Greek, kind of a combination of the two. But Cleopatra was very, very certain in wanting to associate herself with the Egyptians, which was completely unknown to the Ptolemaic dynasty. I'll even take that a step further in saying she was the first Egyptian pharaoh to ever speak the ancient Egyptian language. And the Upper Egyptians, you know, the natives, really loved her for that. They, at the very end of her life, offered to stand up for her against the Romans, and she turned them down, not wanting to bring Octavian's wrath to them. So, you know, I think that's amazing. I think there was a lot more to Cleopatra than meets the eye, as there was to Antony. We know nothing about their plans, what they really envisioned. That part, you know, was all a fictitious, hopefully logical, but fictitious rendering on my part.
Well, of course, we know that she was the mother of Caesar's child.
She was. And Caesarion, you know, must have been raised as learned as she was. Unfortunately, he never lived long enough for us to know enough about him or to have, you know, for him to have made a difference in Egyptian history. She tried for that. She offered to abdicate at the end of her life. So that he could take the throne in her stead, and that was refused her. So, you know, Antony and Cleopatra did really the only thing they could do. You know, they tried their best to defend the city at the very end, and, you know, the taking of their lives, to be honest, they did the only thing they could do, you know, in their day and age.
It's better than to be taken away in chains. What, I mean, is there an explanation why Caesar didn't acknowledge their child as, you know, so that he would take over instead of Octavian?
Yeah, apparently foreign children or quote-unquote bastard children could not be acknowledged in Roman culture. And, of course, that probably drove Cleopatra crazy. But, you know, towards the end of Caesar's life, he was walking a delicate line, too. He had a lot of opposition. You know, he had the Brutus and Cassius types in the Senate, and, you know, one of his biggest and last mistakes was he actually had a temple to Venus Genetrix made, you know, in the Forum, and he used Cleopatra as the model for the Venus statue for that temple. And it was placed in the temple, and apparently it lasted, you know, a very long time through Rome's history, until maybe even the Visigoths sacked the city. But that statue outraged men like Brutus and Cassius and Cicero and, you know, so many of them, Decimus Brutus. And that was very near the time. We don't know exactly the date of the consecration of the temple, at least I don't. But apparently it was very close to the time of the Ides of March. So that may have been the frosting on the cake, you know. The thought of having a foreign queen associated Rome, you know, when he had a Roman wife, when Caesar was married to Calpurnia, was outrageous. You know, you just didn't do that. That was not socially acceptable. It was not politically acceptable in any way. And Cleopatra was very outspoken. There was also a physical boundary within Rome called the Pomerium. And scholars do know kind of where the extent of it was. And, you know, if you read about where Cleopatra stayed, she stayed in a villa that belonged to Caesar, but it was on the opposite side of the Tiber River, so that she was not infringing upon the Pomerium. So that's something interesting, too. They did not want her physically present near the Senate, near the, you know, Capitol. So
all of history would have changed.
Oh, yeah. I think it would have. I think it would. We would have had a lot more tolerance a lot sooner, you know, had they won the war. You know, that's just overall, that would be my best guess. But who knows? We don't even know really, truly what their agenda was. We don't. Nobody does.
Well, that's why your book is so fascinating, and it's so much fun to read. And let's talk. Well, of course, you mentioned your edits. So you had some fun during these past few years. You write the book, then you have to do all the editing, and that's been a process, right?
It has. And to be honest, Patsy, I'm one of the weird authors that loves editing. I do. It's my favorite part of the writing process. Writing is great, you know, writing the initial draft and getting through it, and then the drafting process after that. But once I have a developmental edit, that is my favorite part of the whole process. And, of course, that requires, you know, rewriting a lot of things, axing a lot of things, you know, eliminating things you don't need. And what was really cool for me was in this third book, I didn't have to do quite as much of that sort of thing, because I think Jenny, my editor, and I both kind of shared the same vision as far as where the story was going. Of course, we knew how it was going to end, but exactly how I was going to depict that ending and twist that ending just a little bit. And then I did write an epilogue afterwards. You know, I don't depict in this story, I do not depict the death of Cleopatra. Everybody knows about that.
Yeah.
I ended it with Antony's death, but it's not quite over yet. You know, there's an epilogue, and that's all I'm going to say about that. People will have to read it and
that's
find
right.
out.
People have to read it. That's it. Exactly. Well, yeah, and as I said, it's the years of research that have gone into it have given you that depth and understanding of your characters. And there are so many characters. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah,
how'd you keep track of everybody?
Oh, goodness. Yeah, there were. And, you know, that's one of the things in the edit process. It's like, wow, you know, handling all of these Roman names, you know, there just weren't a huge amount of first names. There was Marcus, Titus, Decimus, Sextus, Quintus. You know, aside from that, you know, you just didn't have a whole lot of first names. And so it's really a headache when you're writing the Roman period, trying to differentiate all of the family members. There were some family members and some sons of generals and things like that I simply, you know, didn't even mention, didn't include in the book, just because I wanted to try to eliminate as much confusion as possible because of the name. It's difficult.
Well, you've handled it beautifully. Now, what's going to happen? Now, of course, so people can get, you know, they can read this book that's coming out on Friday, but they can go back and start at the beginning. And I'm sure that you'll eventually be selling it as a box set, because it will make just wonderful gift for people.
Yeah, I have some plans there. The box set, I want to eventually do audio.
Oh,
version.
Yes, I'm sure. Yes. The Audible will be a lot of fun. And I think that it's such a wonderful, compelling story, and a great. I've really taken to Audible books lately, and I really enjoy them. So I'm sure that you know that's your next step. And
it really is.
Yeah, it will be great, and it'll give you something else to go out there and sell and promote. Although you can't go out. Can't go out and sell and promote like we had planned. I know that you know, I had talked to you about marketing before and how important it was to get out there and meet people. But that's not happening right now.
Not happening right now. Hopefully in the near future. We can hope and pray, right?
Yes, and I hope that you'll be able to. The conventions, because this week I was supposed to be at BoucherCon, you know, for the Mystery Writer of America. The event in convention, which was going to be really, really big, you know, 5,000 people, and they're doing it online, which is not the same, I tell you right now. So it's sad, but I hopefully by next spring, people will be out and about again, and you'll be able to start going to the book shows and the book fairs. And I think this book will do very well in Europe, and I'm sure.
I do, and yeah, one of my hopes is that I'll be able to market it in some of the museums in Rome. I think the Capitoline Museum, several of the others, you know, in Rome might really respond to it favorably. So that's a goal, you know. In fact, that's what I was planning on doing this summer until, you know, COVID-19. So
weren't we all? Weren't we all?
I know it.
You know. it's hard to believe that it's October.
It is,
and that we've gone through this, and you know what have we been doing, and it's really just, you know, crazy. But I have a feeling that what you should do is also hit the Frankfurt Book Fair next year. And of course you'll find there somebody who'll pick it up and translate it for you.
That would be wonderful.
That's the best place where you can meet, you know, European agents who will pick the book up. I think that's one of the most wonderful things. Have you ever been to the Frankfurt Book Fair?
I haven't, but I've heard of it.
It's almost too overwhelming. It's like you go and you say, never end, or you think, just never end. I just want to be here with all these people who love books and all these wonderful books. And
I actually have a friend whose book sold at the Frankfurt Book Fair last year, and her name is Sarah Penner, and she'll be coming out this coming March with her book. It's her debut novel, and it's fabulous. You should check it out.
Well,
it's called The Lost Apothecary.
Hey, she has to send it to me if I read it.
Yeah.
And I'll give her an open date. That's how it works here.
Yeah, okay.
You know, I mean, in your case, of course, I got the recommendation from Margaret George, and I said, well, if Margaret George thinks she's great, I have to have her on the program. So, yeah, so
it's been wonderful, and every time that I have the opportunity to be on your program, I jump at the chance because I think, wow, you know, I love the way you interview. It's so warm and relaxed and welcoming, and you know, for somebody like me who's only been in the industry for a year and a half, that's the kind of atmosphere I need.
Yeah, well, it is. You know, I love reading, you know, that's what I do. And particularly, as I said, it's funny for me, the parts that I love the most were the battle scenes. The romances and all the family things are fun, but I those are the ones that I sort of gravitate to. So you just hit it right. And of course, I know that part of the world, my husband and I actually traveled through Greece and Turkey driving a white Cadillac.
Isn't it a beautiful country?
Oh, it is.
And Greece is, I found Greece to just be so warm. The people are so welcoming. In fact, this Thursday, I'm so floored. My friend, her name is Gordana, who was my guide at Actium, is actually going to be at my virtual launch. And so I'm really excited about that because I will get to introduce her and share a little bit about our adventure the day that I was there. And again, she has just been such a help to me. Even here when I'm in the States and I have a question, you know, to be able to throw it back to some of my guides in either Italy or Greece means a great deal. And they always come up with an answer for me.
There's a lot of possibilities in the future for you. A lot of things will open up because of this book. There's so much more excitement. And I know one of the things that I'm sure would be absolutely terrific is that you get together with a tour group and you lead, you be the leader in once people can start touring around again, once people can start getting out there, because quite a few authors have done that. And they've, you know, it's wonderful to travel with somebody who's knowledgeable and somebody who's actually written the book. So people love to do that. Of course, those cruises, people used to love to take those cruises, but nobody's taking a cruise right now.
Oh, my goodness. You know. I know. I pity the cruise industry.
My husband
and I are avid cruisers, and you know, it's so sad to see how they're struggling. I know another local restaurant that was a favorite of ours just closed yesterday. And, you know, it's just heartbreaking to see these small businesses and these, you know, even the larger ones, you know, such as Royal Carib and Carnival. They're hurting.
Well, eventually they'll start back and they'll have some of those book cruises, which I love.
Oh, let's hope.
You have a lot of different authors there. And you will be among them. And you still have so many wonderful things ahead of you with this. And it's called... The new book is Antonius, Soldier of Fate. It's number 3, the third and final installment of the Antonius trilogy. You've done a terrific job with this. Brooke Allen, I want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. It's always a joy to talk to you. And when you have the audibles, make sure that you come back to me, and I will have you and your narrator on.
That would be so fun. It'll
be fun because I love to have narrators on because it is a way to get people really involved in a book, and it will be fun. So as soon as you have that, you let me know, okay?
I sure will. Okay. I sure will. Thanks so much for having me, Patsy. You're the best.
Okay. Bye-bye now, Brooke.
Bye now.
Okay. Ooh, she's so nice. Her book covers are beautiful. Really, it's an example of... book covers that are connected. All three books have a style, a taste that you know flows through the entire trilogy. And they are really, really beautiful. And her website is fascinating because she has not only about her books, she has about her travels and where she went. And as I said, it was so much fun. I know all of the. So many of these places because my husband and I traveled. We took a white Cadillac from Bremen, Germany, drove it all the way through Europe, all the way through Italy, down across Italy, along the Appian Way, all the way. Took a ferry from Brindisi to Thessalonica. And then we drove through Greece and Turkey all the way to Iran in a white Cadillac. So you can imagine what that did for people. We got treated like royalty wherever we went. It was so funny. We could pull into a little village and people would start running out and they would want to know, you know, oh, whoa, who are you? Who are you? And it was lots of fun. So I know, and with this book particularly because there are so many areas where, as she wrote about Philippi and all of these places I've been to, I've seen them, and I hope that you will read the books and in a few years when we can start traveling again, you will be inspired maybe to, you know, take her books and use that as a tour guide, or by then hopefully she will be a tour guide herself for people who love Roman history. And there are many of you out there, and I know because I love Roman history. I've always been fascinated, and it's great to go beyond Caesar. So there's just so much fascinating information to discover in these books. You will enjoy them. Again, go to her website. It's Brooke Allen. com, and it's a beautiful, beautiful website. And she has a lovely story to tell. And I just was so thrilled that Margaret George introduced us. And of course, Margaret George, another great author. When you finish with Brooke Allen, go in and read some Margaret George. Margaret George wrote Henry VIII, 886 pages, 960 pages by hand. She wrote it all by hand, not once, twice. So if she can do it by hand, there's no excuse for any of you. You have computers, you have tablets, you have, if not, you have certainly, you can get a typewriter. I don't know. Can you get typewriters anymore? I don't know if they even sell them anymore. But, you know, now that's so funny. I wish I had my Selectric. Why did I sell my Selectric? It's crazy. I love that. Somebody has to do a keyboard, a computer keyboard that sounds like a Selectric. It is the most wonderful, wonderful sound in the world. I literally listened to that for 8 or 10 hours a day for, I don't know, so many years, as long as I had that Selectric. And I'm sorry that I let it go because it was beautiful. But there's no excuse. You can start writing. You can start writing by hand. Get yourself a legal pad. And that's what Douglas Brunt did. He wrote his entire book on a legal pad sitting at an airport. So that's all you can do is start. You just have to start. And National Novel Writing Month is coming up in November. It's called NaNoWriMo. All you have to do is type in National Novel Writing Month, and you will find the application there. You apply, you send in your application, and then you are ready on November 1st to start writing your book, 50,000 words. My goddaughter has done it many times, and she's always, always won. She gets that book done in 1 month, and I was inspired and did it myself 1 month. That's the only time I ever did it. I could only do it one time. I couldn't go through it again, but it's a wonderful way to start because you write a book, an entire book in 1 month. And there are all sorts of helps. And well, there used to be groups that you could meet in Panera's and places like that. But now, of course, you have to do everything online. Anyway, remember what I always tell you. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them in an audible book. Or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action. And your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or if you're lucky, a series on the Hallmark Channel. And you never know. I hope that's going to happen for Carol J. Perry. And oh, I want to remind everyone that on October 29th, Lee Child and Andrew Child are going to be joining me. Oh, wow, that's exciting. My goodness, their new book is out, and it is terrific. I get an advanced copy. That's a wonderful thing about this program. I get advanced copies before all of you get to read it, and I get to read it, and I just enjoyed it so much. And I'm looking forward to talking to Lee Child and Andrew Child, and I get to call Andrew Child. I call him Drew. I care about his name. He's Drew to me. Anyway, say something nice to somebody today, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you so much, Big Ed. Everything smells like Clorox number 5 in here, and I really appreciate it. It's getting to me, that's for sure. Everybody, have a wonderful day, and I'm back here on Thursday. Oh, I have some wonderful things on Thursday. Please join me. Okay, bye-bye now.